Well, thanks everyone for coming in. I'll go ahead and get started just for the sake of time, and as folks come in, they can be joining in the conversation. And my name is David Vasquez. I'm one of the campus pastors at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. For this last month, since the beginning of December, my wife Carla and I have had the privilege to be here in the village with our kids, enjoying this community, and also engaging in some conversations. The focus of my conversations, so the ones that I have led, has been around different aspects of immigration. And we have looked over the last month at a wide variety of issues related to immigration, from personal and individual stories to larger sort of social issues related to immigration. So our conversation tonight is part of a larger conversation. If you have been a part of that, that's great, and you can continue to contribute to it. If you have not, hopefully we'll kind of talk in a way that you can feel a part of this ongoing conversation. This comes out for me out of a couple of different, just sort of for some background on myself. My interest in immigration is both personal. I'm originally from Guatemala in Central America. I was born and raised in Guatemala. I came to the United States after high school to go to college and then seminary. And I lived my life, my entire adult life, as an immigrant, something that I had no concept of before I left home, of course. And it's just a change of identity that comes with that sense. And then what I realized is I've lived in a couple of other countries in addition to the U.S., but so all of my life experience has been that of living as someone who's an immigrant outside of the community to some extent. And what I realized is that, like anybody else, my own experiences shape the way... Actually, this is your If some of you are able to share a copy of that, we can get some more later as well. But, yeah. So some of it is personal, my own understanding of immigration from my own experience. Secondly, it's also been, over the years, become a professional interest. I'm interested particularly in biblical narratives of migration. Just because of the way I look at the Bible myself from my own experience, I feel like, more aware perhaps at times that every single biblical character experiences migration at one point or another. Certainly the main characters in the Bible do. But we seldom read them in that way. When I think about my life, the fact that I'm an immigrant shapes a lot of my life. And so I think, well, when we read these stories, we should be mindful of that. Not that that's the only way we understand the stories, but it should shape them. So I'm in the middle of a sabbatical right now for a full year that I'm focusing on the connections between biblical narratives of migration and people's experience of migration. And so that's the focus of my sabbatical. And Wednesday, we'll do a session that will look a little bit more closely at the connection between the two. As I've done several sessions here over the month, and even as I've talked about immigration with others in other places, often in part because of our own approach to life, we are people who like to solve things and address issues. Oftentimes, when people are presented with all of the facts about immigration, we can feel fairly overwhelmed, frustrated, and then basically as to what's the point or what's the solution. We haven't addressed that as directly over the last month, in part because I think it's important to understand the complexity of the issue and then begin to really move towards thinking about what are some of the ways to address the complexities of immigration. So we begin that conversation tonight. We have a very short period of time to address a fairly large topic. So I hope that it can be somewhat of a conversation. I don't want to appear as the expert on this and the one who has the answers, but rather invite a conversation that we'll begin here and hopefully carry out throughout the week. Please know I'm available to just kind of talk about things that you hear today that you agree or disagree with, or if you'd like to hear more about any of the aspects we discuss. The last thing in terms of my own experience that's significant and is probably helpful for you to know about as I address conversation today is that 18 months ago, in a little town called Postville, Iowa, 20 minutes from where I work as a campus pastor at a college, this little tiny town in Iowa, 2,300 people, became the site of one of the largest immigration raids in the history of the country. 400 people were detained, and it left just a spectrum of just a wave of impact that continues to shape that community in very negative ways. It destroyed the community economically. 18 months later, they're still struggling with that. And it, of course, affected directly the lives of those 400 people who were working, many of them in this company for 20 years, and then destroyed much of their community and their lives. And so part of the question is, what happened in Colesville brought this issue of immigration much more to the front of our community's life. And in the wake of the raid, as is the case in most immigration enforcement throughout the country, it is churches that end up doing the response to the human cost of doing this. Once you separate the issues about legality or law from this, which are difficult to completely ignore, but at the same time, they result when you have people caught in the middle of this, families separated from each other, U.S. citizen children separated from their parents, lots of other issues that are raised by enforcement of our current immigration laws, it is the churches that end up doing the response. This was definitely the case in Postville, not only churches, but other religious communities. So I think that it is imperative that churches engage people of faith and communities of faith, not only Christian, but others, engage in this conversation about immigration, that it is something that matters and is important to us. So that's a little bit of introduction in regards to my connections to this topic. In terms of the conversation we have tonight, again, this is part of a much larger conversation, first about immigration. And I'll just make some very brief generalizations here, some very brief comments. The first one is that immigration today is one of the most significant topics that will shape hugely our lives, our children's lives, and our grandchildren's lives. This is a reality across the world, not only in the United States. According to the United Nations Commission, High Commissioner for Refugees, today we have the largest number of people on the move in the history of the world, even more than after World War II, which was one of the largest movements of people. And there's a whole spectrum of factors for this, which we discussed at different times over this month, and I encourage you to be thinking about, and you are familiar with many of them. As you think about your own neighborhoods, the changes in your grocery stores and the products that come. So this massive move of people has followed lots of changes in technology, changes in economics, of how we import products and where we import them from. And so lots of changes have happened. One way that this came fairly clear to me was in a conversation with a grower in Yakima this past summer. He said, it's not a grower, but a picker, somebody who came to the U.S. as a migrant worker in the 50s. He said, when I first came to the United States, there were signs in a lot of the farms that said, no Mexicans. You know, it was clear that you were not allowed to work in certain farms, and there was just a real strong opposition to having people come from other places to work. He said, now you go to any farm, and usually what you'll find is, se habla español. That's the sign. So the signs have changed. The dependence of the United States on immigrant labor is huge in many areas. What has happened as a general trend is that we have outsourced much of the things we can outsource. You know, we've outsourced a lot of our textile production, electronics, lots of the things that require what we may call low-skill labor or manual labor, we've outsourced. But there are certain things we can't outsource. John, a farmer in Posilla, and who works at the church that has been the center of the response after the raid, put it very simply. He said, until we figure out a way to slaughter our cows in China, we're going to have to slaughter them here. And what we do is we grow cows in Iowa. So is that we need to slaughter them here. So one of the things that we have done is we've outsourced many issues, and we are aware of the complexities and issues that come with outsourcing many of our jobs abroad. What we haven't discussed as fully as a nation and as people is the fact that we have also, those things we can't outsource, we have insourced labor for. So when you think about the places that have had a boom in large immigrant labor force, you're looking at things that we can simply not export. Landscaping, meat processing, construction, farming, particularly in vegetables and horticultural things that are not large monocropping of corn and things that can be automated. Increasingly, milking production, that's hugely attracting a lot of workers right now. And I was in a conversation with someone earlier that works with elderly care. That is one of the large frontiers where huge demands for labor are currently statistically unsupported by our current population. There's just simply no way that we will be able to supply the needed labor for some of the things that we need as our population ages. So this is a reality. That's all I want you to keep in mind as we enter this. That immigration is a large, complex reality that we live with, And yet, we need to, both as people of faith, and then we need to demand of our elected officials to figure out a way to address this in a way that is humane, thoughtful, and in touch with our current reality. Because what has happened, and this is what brings us to where we're at today in terms of immigration, is that as the movement of people has increased hugely, think about, for those of you, you know, who maybe are older generation, how much, you know, think about the difference between how much your grandchildren may have traveled already by their age now to how much you may have traveled by their age. So there's lots of mobility of people, both of many people who can move because of technology, resources, and other reasons. But while there's been an increase in the movement of product and, you know, global connections, all of these things, at the same time, our immigration laws have become more restrictive, particularly beginning in the 1980s. So at the time when we were discussing NAFTA, as an example, the North American Free Trade Agreement, that was intended to create large movement of product across the borders of Canada, the United States, and Mexico, we were also discussing how to restrict the movement of people. So what you have is an unsustainable dichotomy, an increase of movement of products in some people, and a huge increase in restrictions on the people that can move to come into the United States to provide labor. People have always followed products. So, for example, Rosa, who was one of the people affected in the immigration raid in Postville, worked for 5 years in, you know, working with Roses. Her name is Rosa, right? But anyway, she worked with Roses in a small village in Guatemala. And she worked in the fields first, made her way into shipping. In shipping, she would label these boxes of nicely cut and prepared roses, and they would be shipped predominantly to the United States, some to Europe. She did this for about 5 years, lost her job. Then she looked for another job. She was the sole provider for both her kids and then her aging mother. Then she found another work, found another job working out in a field picking coffee, and eventually made her way to shipping. And again, she shipped lots of coffee to the United States and to Europe. After 5 years or about, she lost her job again. Nothing to do with her performance or the company. Simply the company folded up and left. Once she found herself without work again and with no job opportunities around her, she went to where the products had gone. She knew where the resources were because she had been shipping them there for 10 years. So she followed the trade, like many people have throughout generations in history, and came to the United States to look for work. What she didn't know is that the reason the company she worked for closed about every 5 years is because a part of the North American Free Trade Agreement includes a 5-year tax-free ride for international investors. So they come in, set up shop, work for 5 years, and then go broke and open up down the road somewhere else or in another country. So whether this is good or bad economically, we can discuss a lot, but it's a reality that it currently is. And so the problem is that when we make our free trade agreements and other such agreements, we don't follow them up with an understanding of their impact on migration and the fact that people historically have and will continue to follow product. So in this dichotomy of growing movement of product and people and growing restrictions, you have at this, what these two things meet is where you have things like Postville happen. So our question tonight, and what remains of our time, is to say, so what do we do about it? How do we address this? How do we address the fact that immigration shapes much of our daily life? Two headlines news today in the New York Times are, one, the claims by an Al-Qaeda unit or group in Yemen and Saudi Arabia for the attack that was thwarted on Friday on a U.S. airplane on Christmas Day. What's significant about this is that this was a Nigerian individual recruited by a terrorist organization in Yemen and Saudi Arabia doing an attack in the United States. This is a reality that we live in a global society, both for the fact that we can buy tortillas just about anywhere we want in the United States and all those other kinds of good things, but it's also a reality about the fact that we have a much more global society. The second thing that was in the New York Times today is that the title of the article says, in Southeast Asia, unease over free trade zone. This is the announcement that on December 31st of this year, the third largest free trade zone in the world following the European Union and the North American Free Trade Agreement will be established in between China and Southeast Asia. So what we have is an increased conviction that free trade and globalization are good forces in the world. And while there is much that comes with that, again, the issue is no discussion is being had in these agreements about the impact it will have on the mobility of people. So that's a long overdue conversation that we need to engage in. The state of comprehensive immigration reform in the United States today is fairly precarious. This conversation has been attempted a number of times over the history of the United States. Immigration law is one of the most complex systems of law. It's sort of like the tax code in its complexity. Because of that, most elected officials are very ill-informed about it and very unwilling to deal with it. Secondly, so one thing is it's very complex. Secondly, it's very controversial. While we have not been able to engage in a conversation, the Congress, whether the House or the Senate, have not engaged in comprehensive immigration reform since 2007, the last attempt at doing this, which collapsed, basically. This year, there's hopes that they will attend to that conversation. They have not gotten there because there's lots of other things being discussed that we're all aware of. Healthcare, economy, war, lots of other issues that seem to be more important. The issue is that immigration is affected and impacts all of these conversations. So what's happening right now, currently, is that our leaders are saying, well, we can't talk about immigration right now because we got all these other things. But what you can notice is when they're talking about the economy, they constantly talk about immigrants and what a problem they are in the economy. When they're talking about healthcare, we're not talking about immigrants, except that we can have somebody yell at the president, you lie, for the first time in the history of the United States, when there's a vague reference to the possibility of undocumented workers receiving any kind of benefit. So the reality is that while we're not talking about immigration, we're constantly talking about it. But we're constantly talking about it in very negative terms. So I think that what's important, and what my hope is in our conversation tonight, is that we realize the need for those of us who are both people of faith, as well as people that have an interest in the well-being of the nation and of our own lives and our future, that we participate in this conversation and that we demand that our elected officials engage in this conversation seriously. In December of this year, on the 16th of December, 15th of December, Luis Gutierrez, who's a representative, so on the House side, from Chicago, introduced a bill for immigration reform called CIR, Comprehensive Immigration Reform, ASAP, which sounds nice for it. It doesn't really mean as soon as possible, but it's nice that it's titled that. It actually refers to security and progress and work and integration. So that's the first bill that has finally been introduced, and the intent is to get the conversation going, at least on the House side. So that at least now there is a bill. I'm only a bill, if you remember the song from Rock House. So it has a long ways to go yet, and it needs a lot of our support so that the bill can make its way through at least conversation. So that's sort of the state of affairs in terms of what we're going to be engaging. Any questions so far? I sort of showered you with lots of details. But. Either the silence of the overwhelmed or the silence of the well-known. Okay. So what I want us to do as a way to frame our conversation is to take a look at a document. This is some of you have a copy of it, and if you don't, maybe we can share some around the room. This is called the Interfaith Platform on Humane Immigration Reform. Now, you may wonder, what can a person of faith, what can I, just as sort of an individual, really contribute to the conversation about immigration? This seems too complicated. It's not something I really need to get involved with. Who am I to tell my elected official how to write the law? Well, that's not our role. Ideally, their job is to understand the law and write something that's representative of the people and in the best interest of the nation. So our role is primarily to become informed and to tell our own stories to those elected. There's been a growing movement in faith communities in realizing the importance of participating in the conversation about immigration. That's happened for a wide variety of reasons. One, like I said, is that the churches and other faith communities pick up the pieces of enforcement as it currently stands. We have an unsustainable immigration law. This is pretty much recognized across the board by most elected officials. They recognize that our current system is not in touch with our economic reality. The devil's in the details about how to then resolve it and what direction to do. So while churches and faith communities are not in the position of starting to write legislation, some parts of our church bodies can help with that, what they can do is provide some principles and guidance. As people of faith, particularly as Christians, When it comes to social issues, we draw from scriptures to be the places that guide and inform our understanding and our contributions to the national conversation. Ideally, we don't seek to impose our religious convictions on others, but we let those religious convictions inform our decision making. This has yet to happen fully in our conversation about immigration. Much of our scriptural resources are lacking in our conversation about immigration. Again, we seldom even realize or talk about the fact that most of the stories that are core to our faith are the stories of immigrants. So that's part of the work that has yet to be done. This document represents one of several documents that have been created by various organizations that are trying to bring the voice of the religious community together around the issues of immigration, to provide elected officials and to provide the nation with some guidance for how to engage in this conversation. This outlines a few principles that we'll talk through briefly on what immigration reform should look like. So we'll walk our way through those and then provide a few more concluding remarks at the end. So we'll just kind of read the titles of them and then talk briefly about each of them. So if you go down to the bottom of the part that is bold, the first principle in there is uphold family unity as a priority of all immigration policies. This has become a central and important part of people who have encountered immigration and the effects of immigration enforcement as a central conviction of faith. As a people, we value family. Much of our conversation, for good or for evil, in the nation is that family values are at the core of who we are. Our current immigration system, as it stands, has very low regard for family unity. It has very little regard for family unity in the case of undocumented workers. You know, if their children are U.S. born and are U.S. citizens, that has nothing to do with whether they are deportable or not. And I'm not talking about undocumented people who are criminals. I'm talking about undocumented workers whose only crime is to have crossed the border undocumented so that they can come and slaughter chickens in Iowa. So for example, 14 U.S. citizen-born children were effectively deported with their families back to poverty in Guatemala and Mexico, where they had never, ever been, children who don't speak the language and who have been then basically will be forced to grow up in poverty and exile. And the question is, what kind of citizens will they make of the United States when they turn 18 and are able to return to the United States? So that's one concern in the current system, is that it does not respect the unity of families in those circumstances. But it also, the current system, does not respect family unity, even in documented, whatever you want to call people who have migrated into the country. If a person comes to the United States as a refugee, for example, or comes under a visa for work or something like that, it can take, for refugees currently, anywhere from 17 to 24 years for them to be able to be reunited with some of their family members. So if you have a child, if you have come escaping your very life to the United States, and you have a child in another country, by the time you're able to bring that child over, they'll be an adult. And so you're given this choice of either returning to a place where your life is at risk, or figuring out a way to provide for your child at a distance. Reunification of families is currently very complex and very archaic within the current system. So that's one thing that I think there's vast agreement within the faith community that we need to, whatever policies are considered, family unification should be a central part of reform. Okay. Please feel free to stop me at any point and ask questions if you have them.
The child who's born here becomes a citizen by nature of birth, even if his parents are here temporarily, legally, illegally, or any way whatsoever. And that must have been considered a wise concept when it was written in the Constitution, when the country was very demographically different. I'm wondering, does the interfaith community question whether that's as relevant today, because it sure creates chaos in all these family situations.
Yeah, I'll say the thing. I think it was a very enlightened, conviction early on in the nation's history to some extent, and that it's not paralleled by all nations in the world. You know, many places, the fact that you're born on the land does not necessarily guarantee you citizenship, but it's tied to your parents' origin and citizenship and status. So that is not unique to the United States, but a significant aspect of U.S. Policy. In terms of its origin, it was very disputed when it happened, in part from the same sort of nativist concerns that we have today. So I think that even though we may think of ourselves as being in a very different place demographically, the same concerns were being had then. There were concerns about the citizenship of African Americans, for example. Even though early on in the nation, African Americans made up the majority of the population in the United States. You know, there were more African slaves than there were Caucasian people in the United States early on during the colony. And yet, their citizenship was questioned. You know, once they were born here, were they citizens? What were their rights? I mean, they certainly weren't given voting rights until the 1800s. So that was one of the major discussions about who would receive citizenship and if it was going to be done by birth. And the same concern was as different groups came in. Every time a new group came in, these discussions came into being. You know, whether it was, you know, if the Germans came first, or actually the Germans came second, they were not the earliest ones, but after the English came, then large numbers of Germans came, other Scandinavians, as each group came in, these debates have resurfaced in U.S. history. There's been times when that debate has become much more violent and much more forceful, you know, leading to things like the Asian Exclusionary Act, you know, Chinese Exclusionary Act, that specifically forbade Chinese people from becoming citizens of the United States. So, I mean, there's lots of, it hasn't been, you know, this sort of clear conviction. Whether it still applies to the United States or not has been discussed. There has been repeatedly, throughout the recent history, a lot of discussion and bills introduced into Congress, both on the Senate side and the House side, trying to revoke this part of the constitutional convictions, you know, to say we shouldn't allow this. People who oppose it call it the anchor. You know, their conviction is they have this image of lots of people running across the border just to have their babies so that they can then become the anchor by which they'll pull everybody in. So part of the restrictions are there. The issue that we face is that in the United States law, a child's well-being trumps any other law. That's usually the case in most things. You know, if a child is orphaned, their property rights are protected against anything else, you know, because we feel that it's important that a child's well-being be considered in every decision that we would make. And when the child's unable to make the decision, a guardian ad litem is assigned for them. That's not the case in immigration law. The child's well-being is not even considered, you know. It's seldom, if ever, considered if deporting the parents is best for the child or not, or whether deporting the child will be important. That's hardly ever considered. It was not considered at all in any of the postal cases. So those things are not necessarily important. And there's no way that these child's rights as a U.S. citizen can be assigned to a guardian ad litem. So that's where we have some inconsistencies across our system and law, where there's particular things about our immigration law that aren't reflected in other aspects of our law. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense in the context of immigration law in the United States. It doesn't make it very pretty.
And the question is whether it even benefits the nation, you know, because that's a serious concern. You know, I think that there's a huge debate that we need to engage in as to whether immigration is a positive or a negative thing for the country. And that's where the ideological debate needs to be had. You know, if you look economically, lots of people will make the argument that we need more labor. You know, certainly our current system does not supply the needed labor. 12 million people are employed in the United States. Well, actually, 12 million people are undocumented. About 8.5 of them are employed because about 4 million are children. So you have, you know, clearly a larger part of the population. When I talk to growers across the country, you know, in certain areas, there is simply no other workers that they can obtain. And so we have an economic need. To what extent? How much? All these important questions.
I think the question for people of faith could be along with, is it good for the nation? I don't think that's the fundamental question for people of faith. I think that it's a question of what is just, and when you look at the imbalance of wealth on this side of a border, you know, and 10 miles down the road, it's so different. I think that people of faith have a different question to look at more fundamentally.
And so that self-interest may not be the only thing to guide our decision, but maybe a larger understanding of law that does not necessarily get limited at the border. And that's part of the difficult conversation for us as people of faith. If we call ourselves, you know, part of the Christian church around the world, for example, you know, what is the role of borders in our understanding of what is just and right That's at least an important part that we need to engage in and think about. And how do we balance those with the needs and values of the nation?
David, before we move off of the family unity piece of the platform, what is the point-based system that's referenced at the end of that paragraph?
The point-based system is basically when individual cases are looked at, and this is part of the reason why, for example, even if somebody's here documented and has lived in the country for a long time, it may take forever to get a family member here, because the adjudication process is very slow, in part because there are not enough judges, there's not enough resources. There's a lot more resources allocated to enforcement of the law currently than there is to just sort of processing people, you know, to get through their immigration system. So what they usually will do is that they rank people based on what's important to the nation. The point system is actually the place where the last round of immigration reform totally collapsed. Because what do you value most? Chicken processing? Is important or not? Or do we want more programmers? What's more important? What does the nation need? What's more valued? And you have lots of interests in this, you know? And the reality is that the 100,000 farm workers working in the Yakima Valley aren't going to have the same lobby and voice to make their points count than Google will in how many engineers they need, you know? And so the point system tries to determine what the value the nation places on individual immigrants and for what we need out of a purely economic decision or a political decision. You know, we want certain groups of people to come. And so that is, again, when it gets really tricky and very heavily fought out.
Human capital.
Yeah. And the thing is that, again, we need to balance our commitments as Christians with the hard realities that we may need to address. And so how do we as people of faith speak to both of those with a level of understanding and wisdom? You know, how do we help those who are among us having to make tough decisions about who they hire if they can find workers other than people who are undocumented? How do we help their voices be heard and considered as well? Or our neighbors who are part of our church, who go to school with our kids, and that we know what their situation is like. How do we make their points count? Other questions as we make our way through?
Can you just say, refugees would be an entirely different category, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, and comprehensive immigration reform seeks to look at the entire ball of wax. Because part of the issue we have is not only undocumented, it's really only a fraction of the people we are dealing with. A refugee is someone, let me put it this way. At the end of World War II, after most of the settling began to happen, when the High Commissioner for Refugees was established in the UN, there was what they called refugees of concern. And the numbers at the time, I believe, were 100,000 people. No, sorry, 500,000 people that needed to be, 1.2 million people, sorry, get my numbers confused. So there was a large number of people that needed to be resettled. And that's when the concept of refugee, the modern concept of refugee, was established. And they basically said, who is a refugee? A person who meets a certain standard. You know, they're prosecuted for issues around gender, race, faith convictions, and so they are forced to leave their country under duress. And we currently have 10 million people that are categorized, so 10 times what we had at the end of World War II, categorized by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees as refugees. So these are people that we know about are in Sudan, Iraqis, all over the world. We still have people like the Hmong who continue to come who were displaced during the Vietnam War. So, you know, these are people that are all over the world. Many people are in transition as refugees for up to 20, 30 years. We don't resettle that many refugees. We resettle less than 1% of refugees around the world. And those are people who have been brought to a different country. The majority of refugees, the hope is that eventually they'll stay where they're at and be able to establish in those countries or be able to return to their country. So we take a very small percentage of those people in the world and actually resettle them. Those decisions are made very strategically about who it would be best to resettle. You know, if you have a population that's under greater distress, an individual, or there's a political reason. Right now, we are resettling large numbers of Iraqis because there is a sense of responsibility about their movement. And so because of that, the vast majority of refugees accepted into the United States this year will be Iraqis. And so there's particular reasons, those are political decisions that are made to some extent at a global level. The distinction in the United States is that the United States maintains a number of refugees, and that's determined every year. How many refugees out of this, so you have a huge population, 10 million people, only 1% would be resettled in a given year. A large portion of those will end up in the United States. The United States has to make the decision about how many they will take. So that's one set of visas for them to come. They usually come documented. They're provided some minimal resources by the government. And then they're usually helped by institutions like Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Services, which is one of the largest. They resettled 10,000 refugees last year and will do the same this year, which is over 10% of the entire population of refugees that are resettled into the country. So does that make sense? So that's one category. Then you have people that come on their work visas, specific work visas that we need. That's where we have some issues. For example, we only have 5,000 low-skill work visas. That's it. There's no other way that a person who wants to come pick your apples in Washington State can come if it's past the 5,000. Well, one valley, the Yakima Valley, needs about 100,000 people. So this is just unrealistic. It simply just has nothing to do with reality.
The whole country's 5,000.
Yep. And so, you know, and then on top of that, you'll have a few others. You have H-1 visas, you have other visas that have to do with specific skills. You know, if you want to come, people often that are pros, undocumented workers being in the country say, get in the line. You know, as if people's choice was simply, I don't want to fill out the paperwork, you know, and then to go kill cows in Iowa. There is simply no way. There is no line to stand in. So part of it is tying in our economic reality to our immigration policy. What do we need? Of course, setting that number will again be political and difficult. Who gets to determine how many people we need? Farmers, growers, meatpacking people will probably want a surplus of labor. You know, they want more people than what they actually need so that there's some competition. So determining those numbers would be hard. But we gotta move from 5,000. I mean, that's simply unrealistic.
Is there any country that does any better than we do?
In some regards, and in some regards not. I mean, you know, I think it's important to acknowledge the United States has, some fairly decent aspects of our law in terms of helping incorporate people. It has a history of doing that in many respects. Percentage-wise, we don't do so well in terms of the size of our nation, and also when you consider our role in the world, which is, I think, one aspect that we have to consider. If you think about the fact that refugees follow trade, we are one of the largest importers of everything from all over the world. So for us to expect for the nations to bring all their wealth to us, but for them to stay home, is simply unrealistic. So you have to factor all these things. So I would say we have some aspects of our nation, certainly people in the country. I don't think our current immigration system reflects our values, for example. I think that there's a deep disconnect. It certainly doesn't represent the myths, the stories we tell ourselves. You know, we got around Thanksgiving. We tell ourselves stories about who we are. And these myths do not match our current immigration system. So I think it's kind of divided. There's aspects where other countries do worse than we do and aspects where they do better. I think, for example, the Canadian system right now, both in dealing with documented immigrants, is much better. There was an article in the New York Times about a year ago, that Google had to open an office in Calgary, you know, because they could get the people they needed from all over the world to Calgary with papers and their families, while in California they could only get them by themselves for 6 months without their families, you know. And so it's basically shooting ourselves in the foot, right? We're sending. One of the things that's happening, there was a study done by the sort of Association of Colleges looking at brain power. And one of the things that they said is, we no longer can assume that the United States is the destination of choice. That is no longer the case globally. Rather than thinking of only human, you know, like brain drain, which is a concern we need to be aware of, we have to realize that we have entered a time of basically capital circulation, where people move to different countries following trade and following employment. And people will choose to go to the place where they feel more welcome, where they feel that they have a better opportunity to go. So for some areas, like for people maybe coming, poor people coming from South America, Central America and Mexico, they may not have a lot of choices. But some of the other aspects of immigrants that we need will. And the way we treat one will affect the perception of the other. Okay. We're going to run out of time. Okay.
Of course.
Let's just kind of highlight briefly the other things. I do want to move to one other document real quick. Create a process for undocumented immigrants to earn the legal status and eventual citizenship. This has become an important central piece that will be heavily debated in any discussion about immigration. What to do with the estimated 12 million people currently in the country who are here already undocumented. Many of them have been here since 1986 or prior to the last time that there was an amnesty. So we have people who have been in the country for 20, 30 years and have lived their entire lives undocumented. And so we're talking about a complex situation of lots of people. The idea that we can deport them all, which is what has guided enforcement in the last 9 years. There was, right after 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security was shaved. All these things happened nationally because of our fear of the other that came out, somewhat, in many ways understandably out of 9/11, but in many ways overreaction in other areas of it. Resulted in this plan as part of immigration enforcement that was called the final, the end game. You know, it's really troubling, even in its language. It sounds much like the final solution. The end game had a tag, and this is in the documentation of immigration, that it was called 12 by 2012. The idea that they would deport 12 million people out of the country by 2012. We keep in our memory the tragedy of the Trail of Tears, of the displacement of Native Americans across the country. This would pale in comparison just in numbers. It is simply impossible. That's part of the experience that we've had in Postal in the small community, where you cannot hide the impact of trying to remove people out of the country. I mean, there are students, our church members, our leaders, our workers. These are not people who are somehow isolated from the rest of the society. We can't tear them out of our communities. And so I think there's a growing awareness of the fact that we can't deport our way out of this problem. So we have to figure out a way for people to find a pathway to earn citizenship. So.
Why Postville and not the Yakima Valley?
Economics, I think, in part. You know, they've done different enforcement. They did one in 2001 in Yakima that blew up. I mean, the level of reaction in the community was so strong, that they just realized there was no way to do that publicly. It's really difficult to say why they have their sort of published reasons as to why Postville. My sense is I think they assume it would be a hidden community. It's pretty small. I think in many ways they thought, we'll give this a shot, see how it works. Because they tried many different things there that they hadn't done in other enforcement. And I think they never expected it to blow up the way that it did and to get the kind of national attention that it received. Because it did become in some ways the pinnacle of enforcement. I mean, it was one of the worst raids. And I think did have the effect of bringing a lot of public attention to it. That has, both with the change of administration, at least reduced that form of enforcement. Keeping in mind that while we know we cannot deport 12 million people, we're still trying really hard. 420,000 people will be detained this year by immigration. This is without raids. 420,000 people will go through immigration jails this year alone. It was 350,000 last year, and every year has increased, even under the current administration. So that while, and this is not criminals, this is predominantly, the percentage of criminals, as the number of people detained has increased, the percentage of them who have criminal records other than having entered the country undocumented has shrunk. And there's talk about trying to, focus on immigrants who may be an issue, but that has yet to really pan out.
This might be a dumb question, but it sounds like, legalizing the people here, most of from what your numbers were, most of them except for the children have jobs. Mm-hmm. So by legalizing, they're getting taxes.
Well,
they're what, a drain on the system because they're using the medical and the school and
they're
paying in the medical and school and roads like that.
That's one of the arguments for legalizing people, is to say that you would have a better way to be able to count their taxes and administer their taxes. It's a little tricky, because on the one hand, the majority of undocumented workers in the country actually pay taxes. If they don't, it's because their employers aren't paying them. You know, if I'm the employer in the United States, I'm responsible as the employer, unless the person's self-employed, to withhold their taxes and make sure they pay them. I mean, this is not left up to the goodwill of everybody to pay their taxes. And so the only way that an undocumented worker doesn't pay taxes is if the employer is paying them under the table or not paying their taxes. What often happens is they'll withhold it. If they don't know they're undocumented, then they'll pass that money on to the state, which often happens. So lots and lots of money has been piled up into Social Security, Medicare, and other tax forms, you know, where people pay. So one of the big myths is that undocumented workers don't pay taxes. They pay taxes in what they shop for, they pay taxes on income, and whether it's withheld from their paycheck, unless, again, the employer is not withholding it. In other cases, the employer is well aware that they're undocumented, will withhold the taxes and not pass them on to the government. So there are some issues here in terms of who this would affect to legalize people. One of the fears that's used often is, well, then we're going to have, you know, we're in a tough job economy, you know, what are we going to do incorporating these people into the system? Well, they're already working. You know, documenting them, legalizing them, isn't necessarily going to sort of make those jobs disappear. In fact, like, again, it was noticed in Postal, it's a microcosm, you can't necessarily apply it completely, but out of 1,200 workers, 900 were undocumented. But when the company shut down, all 1,200 lost their jobs, including 300 who were documented. You know, so this is an issue that you can't just remove all of these workforce, and then what happens to the farmers? What happens to the people whose jobs depend on these workers? So it's a complex thing. On the other hand, one of the advantages of documented people and providing them a legal station is that then they have the biggest fear for people not to organize, not to, you know, expect their rights and be treated fairly and get a better wage is because they're undocumented and they're afraid of immigration. So if you legalize folks, then the idea is that they will have a better opportunity to improve their own situation. Part of what we look at in history is what happened in 86, you know, where the legalization process was done, an amnesty of 2 million people. It had all of these effects. It improved the conditions of work in a lot of people. It certainly created some havoc in the areas where these people were employed, because all of a sudden they were organizing and negotiating their pay, which they had never done before. And so some people, especially, you know, growers, for example, or other areas, got freaked out about it. So there are some interests who would rather not have them documented. And it's not a simple thing. Documented all of these folks, many people say, well, once you document this 12 million people, then everybody else is going to think you're rewarding people who come in undocumented, right? So we're going to have this whole suction of people coming up. The assumption is that the amnesty of 86 is what caused all these people to come. That may be part of the equation, but most people weren't necessarily aware of the 86 amnesty. Most of the people who have come to the United States in the last 20 years are under 20 years old. So they don't even know necessarily about that. They've come because they know where their products have come. They know where the economy is going. So there's other factors as well. This isn't, you know, legalizing them should be considered. How do we do it? But that's not the only reason that will kind of drive lots of people to that. I'll just read the last couple of things, and then I do want to get to one other document, which I'll start passing as I wrap this up. Oh, no time. Here we go. I'll give you this one here. The last two things on here are protect workers and provide efficient channels of entry to new immigrant workers. So again, once people are documented, how do you protect workers? What drives wages down is the exploitation of people, not the presence of immigrants. It's not one thing that is unrelated to the other. Facilitate immigrant integration. Again, there's a lot of resources that can and should be utilized. And I think this is a place where the faith community needs to stand up as well. Not only in calling for change, but in saying, okay, let's say we get what we're asking for. And we got this major integration of 12 million people into the country coming out of the shadows. Well, churches are going to have to step up to the plate and offer resources to help people integrate. This is a place that I think our churches can offer English as a second language, other resources to help people come into, just even getting documentation, applying for processes. There's a lot of opportunity for ministry and for really living out our call as people in service to our neighbors. Restore due process protections and reform in detention policies. Again, a huge issue to discuss. There's some details in there. when you think about just the numbers of people being detained and the number of abuses that have happened in those detention centers, it is really scary. It is scary because if you're detaining that many people and you build that many jails to hold them, let's say that you are done with it, that you no longer have 420,000 immigrants to detain, you still have a business that needs to be fed. So who's the next group of people you're going to decide have broken the law so you can start jailing them? I mean, it seems like, you know, something out of you're just, you know, being too concerned about something that isn't going to happen, but this is the reality that we have seen in the past, you know, when there is this sense of, once we get used to, as a nation, incarcerating a large percentage of our population, this is something that's a hard habit to break. And the biggest issue here is that undocumented workers and even documented immigrants have many of their protections that we would count on as basic are not respected. And aligned enforcement of immigration laws with humanitarian values. This goes back to what you had said before about the importance of saying, how do we as a people live? What are our values? Finally, the second piece I passed out, and we won't get a chance to talk as much about. I joke, but we can make some more, and I'll have them available afterwards in the back if you'd like to pick up some more copies of it. This last document is something that we had done shortly after the immigration raid in Postal as a response to faith communities asking just at least some basic direction of resources to begin the conversation within our churches. My hope is that while this conversation can seem so overwhelming, I don't think that you need to become an expert on immigration or understand it all to be able to make your voice heard or to engage in it. There are steps that we can each be engaged in, both as individuals and as congregations, in addressing this conversation. So this is a document that tries to help to do that and provide some very kind of basic steps, at least as a beginning place for you individually or for your communities of faith. The first part kind of gives a real brief rationale connecting this to our faith values, to our core stories. The second part talks about beginning with your own community. Who are the people in your congregations who are immigrants? What are the basic stories in your community of faith as an immigrant church? Many of our churches are immigrant communities. So some of it is just changing attitudes and awareness, at least to begin to debunk some of the myths and misunderstandings about immigration and to overcome some of the fear. In the Christmas story, which we have been rehearsing for the last couple of weeks and throughout the season of Advent, we have all these angels showing up to everybody. What's the first thing all these angels say? Fear not. Do not be afraid. I think that's the core message of the gospel. And it's a message that the church needs to engage in, to simply figure out a way in which it is not fear that directs our actions. It is important to be guarded in a time of lots of conflict and a complicated world. But fear should not be the foundational motivation for what we do. And so I think that is part of where the church needs to preach the gospel to its own members and to the community of not living or deciding by fear. So that's a place to begin. Secondly, I think it's important to call for change. And resources for educating yourselves vary widely. Lots of things are available online. There's a few resources listed on the back page here. There's a lot of books that run the gamut. There's one recent one that's called Christians at the Border that comes with, and I'll leave these out here, with a guide, study guide that can be used in congregations. We use this in the Cora, the community, a couple of churches in town. It's called Strangers in the Land. These two kind of go together. You can use only this one for discussion, or you can read it along with the book. And it basically tries to make the connection between faith, biblical stories, and immigration today. There's a little bit more in-depth discussions that are similar to that. We'll be discussing this book on Wednesday, Santa Biblia, which looks at the Bible through Hispanic eyes. It's just a really good resource to understanding a particular part of the immigrant community, the Hispanic community, and its contributions to the Church of the United States. This is a great book, Jonah, Jesus, and Other Good Coyotes. This book looks at the connections between kind of border crossing and peace in the biblical text. And it looks at people like Jesus, Jonah, and others, that Moses, and others that cross borders as part of their kind of broadening of the ministry. There's some really, increasingly, there's some, not as much as I think there should be, but we've been discussing a couple of books that are novels. So these are fiction based on individual stories. One is called Illegals. There's some copies of that available in the dining room if you want to take a look at those. And while I've been here, somebody gave me this book, The Tortilla Curtain. Both of them were written in the 90s, mid-90s, and so they're somewhat dated in some regards, but unfortunately much of what they point to continues to be the case today. So I would recommend those two.
There's another good book, nonfiction, The Devil's Highway.
Yes.
Which University of Washington chose this year as their freshman book, or last year. Yeah, every freshman had to read it.
So that's another, you know, good resource. This one is also from the 90s, With These Hands, and I got this one here from Karen, and I really have appreciated it. It's a lot of interviews with people who have worked. This primarily focuses on manual labor in the fields, and it is really an incredible read in terms of understanding the reality of migrant workers, not only immigrant migrant workers, but United States migrant workers, and the history of it in the United States. So again, you can go as in depth, and there's lots of good resources out to look at. So educating yourself and then advocating, I think, is important. The last thing I'll say is, as I worked on the back, there's some resources. One of them is a website that I'm working on that's called Faith on the Move. And my hope in there is that that becomes a conversation. So I encourage you to maybe check that out and contribute to it. But the last thing I'll say is just that over the last 18 months, following the raid in Postville, one of the things that I found myself needing to do and be involved in is in advocating with elected officials, both around the state in Iowa, but also in Washington. And the number one comment that most elected officials have made is, we do not hear enough about immigration, at least in terms of any kind of nuanced approach. Mostly they'll hear from people who don't want any more immigrants, who are afraid, but they do not necessarily hear a lot from people who are interested in engaging the conversation more seriously. So even though it can feel like repetition of things you hear in many other topics, it is important that you make your elected officials aware of what matters to you about immigration and to share the stories that you have with your elected officials. If they are supportive of reform, they need the feedback and they need to be able to know that they don't stand alone. And if they oppose reform of immigration or disagree with your views of it, they need to hear your views as well. So, thank you very much. Sorry that we didn't have a lot of chance to talk, but I look forward to it. Thank you.